park.
This meeting of the Senate Health, Housing, and Family Security Committee will come to order. We're past deadline, so we don't have any bills, but we do have two presentations, and we'd like to begin with the confirmation of Commissioner of Health. Commissioner Magnin, welcome to the committee. While you're coming up, I want to say I've heard not only before your appointment and wonderful things about your credentials and experience, but people who have been working with the department since that time have said good things about what you're doing there. So we're glad to have you here before us today. Do you have an opening statement you'd like to make?
Yes, I do. Good afternoon, Chairman Marty and honorable members of the committee. I am Dr. Sandy Magnin, and I began serving as the Minnesota Department of Health's commissioner on November 2nd, 2007. I was appointed by Governor Pawlenty, and I work closely with his administration and the members of the legislature, and I serve the citizens of Minnesota. I am a physician and scientist by training, and I'm a leader by experience. I bring that experience to further the mission of MDH, which is to protect, enhance, maintain, and improve the health of all Minnesotans. The governor and I discussed my interest in prevention, particularly in preventing the top preventable causes of illness and death, tobacco, physical inactivity, unhealthy eating, and alcohol. When I asked the governor what success looked like for the commissioner of health, he said it was two things. First, that MDH would remain a strong organization through strong public health infrastructure, and that Minnesotans would be protected against any public health threats. And second, that the commissioner of health would use that position to advance health care reform. Since coming to MDH, I have been very impressed by the expertise and the professionals at the organization, and I feel honored to work with such dedicated public servants at MDH. I've also been impressed with the members of the legislature, and I've met, I believe, with each one of you, and have enjoyed those conversations and your input, and I look forward to those relationships moving forward, if you so confirm. I know that all of us really want to make a difference in the health of Minnesotans. I commit as a commissioner to uphold the laws of Minnesota, the data practices law, and the open meeting laws. I commit to be transparent and open in my dealings at the Minnesota Department of Health. And I believe you have seen my approach with my background in science and evidence-based medicine. You've seen my approach with issues such as the quality pork processing plant investigation, the mesothelioma report that I released in the second month in office, which lays the foundation for the minor studies, which I know that you're considering with the University of Minnesota, how I've been handling freedom to breathe and upholding that law, and my involvement and my staff's involvement and support in exploring healthcare reform in the state of Minnesota. I've also reached out to the local public health and have met with a number of those organizations. I have my statewide advisory group that meets with local public health and see them as strong partners in achieving our mission at MDH. So I know that MDH has many divisions that you count on in your work, and I am proud that we have such outstanding expertise and staff to contribute to the policymaking process within our state. We did not get to be ranked number one or number two in state health rankings without your support of our agency and without the governor's support of our agency. Although there's much work to be done, I feel privileged to work at MDH and have the excellent leadership staff in our state to further the health of all Minnesotans and to make certain Minnesota continues to be a healthy place to live and work. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. And as we talked shortly after your appointment, I mentioned to you that I, in future confirmations, and you just happened to be the first one, that I wanted to make sure we ask commissioners for their commitment on several issues. I think you spoke briefly to a couple of them in your opening statement, but I would like to say what they are and just get your comments on them. The first of which is asking you, and again, this is not meant to put you on the spot, but I think every commissioner should be asked this, and I'm asking my colleagues to begin doing this for confirmations, but commitment that you won't scold or punish employees for talking with legislators or the media or anyone, as long as they make it clear they're not speaking for the department. I've seen real troubling things where individuals, constituents, want to come talk to their legislators or to other legislators about issues of concern, and they're clearly not speaking for the agency. They make it clear they're speaking as individuals, and yet they feel intimidated against doing so, in some cases scolded or reprimanded formally for doing so. And that was one of the issues. The second one, which, again, I heard you mention, was a commitment to respect not just the letter but also the spirit of the data practices and open meeting law, because I know we have had experiences where in some agencies employees was told don't put controversial matters in writing because then there's a paper trail that the Data Practices Act can uncover. And the whole point of the Data Practices Act is so that we can track down histories and so on. And then the final one was a commitment that you as commissioner recognize that your job is not, you don't work for the governor, you don't work for the legislature, you work for the people of Minnesota, and your job is to do the best you can as head of the Minnesota Department of Health, and as you mentioned very well in your statement, representing the public health needs and all the other functions of the Department of Health, and that while you are obviously going to be presenting things on behalf of the governor, you'll be representing at the Capitol here the governor's positions on issues, but I also want to ask commissioners to be honest about the needs of the agency, honest about open about voicing your opinions, your concerns, even if they're contrary to the direction of the administration. And the one example I'll give of that is today's Star Tribune had an article on sexually transmitted infections rising in the state and increasing, chlamydia increasing by 3.7% last year, and that national study last week or two, 3 weeks ago, it talked about one in four teenage girls have at least one of the most commonly sexually transmitted diseases. And my understanding of the way the budget process used to work before any of us were around was that commissioners would present the agency budget, not with the governor. They would present it to the governor and to the legislature, and then the governor would react as appropriate, and we would as well. And I realize that's not the way things are done now, but if you present next year the governor's budget for the health department, that at least you'd be open to, when you're presenting it, saying, you know, I have, in the example of the sexually transmitted infections, I have real concern that we're not getting hold of that, and it would be very nice if we could do this, and I'd love to see us invest X amount more in order to do this and that. That's not the administration position, but I want you to know that. I think that part of your role is working on public health would be to be reflective of that. And this morning's article talked about an attempt to seek $1.3 million in state money for screening and public education related to sexually transmitted infections. It was not an administration position, but just in the future, I would love to, even if they're not administration positions, that a commissioner reflects his or her values and concerns and be willing to stand up for that, even if it's contrary to the governor or a legislature, but that you recognize that you are representing the people of Minnesota as commissioner. And I just would love your comment, commitment on those issues, again, because I think we've needed that in the past.
And thank you. Chairman, and members of the committee, a number of things in there. Let me take some of those points and tell you some of my thinking behind them. First, I think the words to say that I would ever punish or scold employees would not be consistent with my leadership style in any issue in that way. Certainly, I want employees to be able to share their expertise, their technical expertise, with the legislature and appreciate what they bring in that way. Certainly, as we at MDH discuss policy issues, have a vigorous debate and discussion about them, but then decide about what's the best approach, then I expect, just like in any business and any organization, that people rally behind to achieve our mission, because we've had time to be able to do that. So I would expect that employees, if, say, for example, freedom to breathe, that we're trying to uphold that law, and we've talked about the best way to do it and how to go about it, that employees would continue to uphold that. If employees at any time, as a private citizen, want to talk with their legislature, that I would fully support, but I think that should be done outside of business hours, and it should be clear that they are speaking as a private citizen and not speaking as an employee of the Minnesota Department of Health. Concerning documentation, certainly uphold the Data Privacy Act. I think that was actually, those laws were created before email was in existence. And so if you had disagreements or thoughts about something or just the first idea in your head, you didn't put it down on the email. You went next door down the hall and you talked with someone about it. I recommend for everyone that you never write emails when you're angry. You never write emails that you're going to look back and go, that was stupid. Or you never write emails that you would be embarrassed if they were flashed up on the screen here with that. But certainly do not want to prevent people from being able to have vigorous discussion, debate, encourage that, so that we can develop good policies. We can have good ideas on the table and talk about their pros and cons in that kind of way. So that I certainly encourage with my employees. And just at a recent, I have a health steering team that brings together the leadership at MDH. And at a recent meeting, we had had a discussion about an issue. And at the end of the meeting, one of the staff said, after we had thought we had agreed about, you know, what we had, and she said, you know, I disagree. And so we had more discussion about it. And then subsequently, I called that employee and said, you know, that's the exact kind of behavior I want at my health steering team. If someone disagrees, I want that out on the floor. Because disagreements I see as learning opportunities and ability to be able to vigorously discuss an issue. Concerning approaching policy issues as an appointed health official, here's how I think about it, and it's been influenced by the book I told you, Senator Marty, that I was reading, Creating Public Value, Strategic Management and Government by Moore. He's a professor at the Kennedy School of Government. And I just finished reading the book, and in the last chapter, he talks about how appointed public officials deal with issues such as you referenced. And first, that when there are policy decisions, that there's a chance for people to have vigorous input into it. But as an elected, an appointed official, that I would respect the will of the people in the people that they elected to make the decisions. So I would support policy that has been decided and vigorously debated, but I would respect the elected officials and their recommendations of that. That I would come forward, however, if I ever thought that in a policy discussion that there were fundamental injustices or corruption or something illegal or unethical that was being done, that as an appointed public official, I should bring those kind of things forward in policy discussions. So those are some of my thoughts about what you have said or asked me to consider, Senator Marty.
Thank you, Commissioner, and I appreciate your comments. I did want to press a little bit harder on the last one, your point that if something is unethical or unjust or something, that you would speak out. Again, I recognize, even though I don't think it's a good way, the way we've been doing it in the state in the last couple of decades is where the commissioner goes to the governor works out with the department what the budget is, and then presents the budget, the administration's budget to us. And I understand that, and your job, as you mentioned, as an appointed official, is to carry out the will of the elected leadership. The one point that I wanted to go beyond is maybe it might not be seen as unethical, or I mean, you might question whether it's unjust or not that we not address an issue like the example I gave from today's paper of the sexually transmitted infections, but that you would still be, for instance, presenting the administration's budget on that issue next year, say, presenting the department's budget, and then say, if somebody's asking, certainly, and maybe on your own, say, you have to recognize that we have a growing problem with this, and I'm concerned we may not be doing enough, and if you want to do this, it would cost us much more, and that you think we ought to be alert to the fact that there's a problem there, and you as Commissioner of Health don't want the public health to continue going backwards in this area. So I guess I wanted to pursue that to the point of asking, instead of what about if it's not something you consider unethical, you may not consider it unethical to not address the need of STIs, but maybe it's something that's not good public health. And again, not saying that you're supposed to be saying, I disagree, but at least somehow or another raising it with the legislature that the budget you've just presented may not accomplish what you as a public health official think would be appropriate.
Well, let me comment in several ways. You're right that the development of budgets are not public data. However, I can say that the recommendations brought forward with the current budget reflect recommendations that my staff made. I worked hard with my staff to have that come from grassroots on up to make recommendations in that way. I can't really speculate on exactly what I would do in the future, a hypothetical scenario, but I can tell you that walking that fine line that I described in being an appointed official and being a responsible, ethical, outstanding official is a fine line to walk, but I will walk that with the utmost integrity and respect for the citizens of Minnesota and how I would move forward, Senator.
I appreciate that, and again, as I said, I've heard very positive things about your integrity as well as your experience and skills. Are there questions from the committee? Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, I don't really have a question. I just have a comment to make, and that is that I think we are just so extremely fortunate in this state to have Commissioner Mangum come forward and be willing to take this job. Her experience, her background, her knowledge in a variety of areas is very timely in terms of the kinds of things that we need to do moving forward as a state. And I know that she will try to impress and educate the governor on the needs that the state has in the area of health care. And while she might not always be successful, she will be an advocate for those needs within this administration. And I think that's all we can ask for anyone, from anyone who is a commissioner who works for another elected official. And so I just believe that we should really be welcoming her into this position with open arms across party lines in the legislature.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, welcome. I wanted to just say that several times today, and frankly several times in our previous discussions, you have mentioned your commitment and desire to serve all Minnesotans. And do know that that is noted and much appreciated. Commissioner, I wonder if you might talk to us a little bit about what your plans are or how you see that together we can better foster the relationship between the department and the legislature.
Thank you, Chairman Marty, Senator Lynch. I think it starts with what I started doing when I first came, is relationships and building those relationships. I believe I met with every one of you. I've met with a total of 35 legislators now, trying to listen, hear their perspectives, their ideas. The legislature is a place of ideas, a place for people to bring things together and discuss and debate vigorously. I certainly want to continue those relationships because I think that's how good policy is made. I want to make certain that my staff and Senator Berglund, I want to say thank you for stating on the Senate floor last week that we had the best health economics division in the country. I agree. And there are many more areas within Minnesota Department of Health that are outstanding. So I want that expertise to be used by the legislature to help make good policy decisions. So I think it's relationships, it's staying in communication, it's continuing to vigorously debate ideas that we can have a good relationship and good going forward. May I ask Senator Marty, Senator Lentz, your thoughts on that and how we can continue to have a good relationship?
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, I think that you're off to a very good start. I always think that any time that we can exchange and entertain ideas on a professional level, that that's always a good thing. And I frankly believe that some of our strongest policy comes forward as a result of input from many stakeholders, from the department, from people on the ground, from legislators of both parties.
Senator Coring has asked if he can make the motion. Is there further discussion from members of the committee or questions? And I do want to follow up one thing on your point, Senator Berglund. I recognize and I think the commissioner will do a good job of fighting internally in the administration to getting funding. I just want to say that I think the commissioner also has an obligation to us. Again, when you've got 1 in 4 teenage girls with sexually transmitted infections right now, that's a major public health problem. And again, the commissioner doesn't have to say, I'm asking for more money than the governor, but at least to alert us at the legislature, not to just clam up and never say another word, but to recognize that they might be saying there are other ways you can do it other than saying I'm trying to, doesn't have to say she's going against the governor if so, but at least say there is this problem here. It's a great concern as a public health official. If we are to do something, I mean, there are ways of phrasing it so she's not directly saying we need this, but if we are to address that concern, we would need so and so much money. Because I think it's not just to, once the door is shut, once the governor has said, here's what the budget's going to be, I think the commissioners, as albeit appointed officials, they are representing the people of Minnesota, and I think it's part of their job to use their personal expertise and wisdom and knowledge and let us know of those issues, even if it's not reflected in the budgets. Senator Berglund.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the Department of Health is a wealth of information. They have a lot of just really, really good information on a lot of subjects. And I do not believe that Commissioner Mann would ever hide any of it from us. I think the Department of Health and all the employees there want us to use all the information they have. And I might add that I think when we use the information they have, we make better decisions. And so I think we're very lucky that we have as much information as we do at the Department of Health. And I believe and trust that this commissioner will not only make it available, but encourage us to use it.
And Senator Dow, and I want to acknowledge, I think this commissioner is a wonderful choice. And my point is I think every commissioner should be committed to making sure they're open with us about the concerns, even not bucking. It's a fine line between violating what they feel they're supposed to be representing through the governor's office, but also that they recognize that, as in this case, representing public health of the people of Minnesota, that we should be in the loop as well. Senator Dow, and then we'll have Senator Coring's motion. Senator
Dow. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome, Commissioner. I'm one of the 35 that you met with, and I enjoyed that meeting. I recall an article that right after you were appointed, where you said one of the kind of the key that for you is to help improve, if I'm probably paraphrasing this, but help improve the physical, mental, and spiritual health of Minnesotans. And I believe that's what you want to do. And I know when we had our conversation, you know, it really just, I was struck by your genuineness and just you're a real person, and you're, you know, your heart is right where it needs to be. And I know that you're going to do a great job. So I just wanted to thank you for being here and doing the good work that you're doing.
Senator Corrin.
Mr. Chairman, I so move that the committee, the Health, Housing, and Family Security Committee, recommends that the appointment of Sane Magnin as Commissioner of Health be confirmed.
Senator Corrin moves that Dr. Sane Magnin will be confirmed as Commissioner of Department of Health. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Commissioner, good luck. We need you there, and I've heard good things. I'm sure that'll continue.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have two presentations now. The first one is, I believe, Department of Health mainly is going to be making the presentation, but the American Heart Association as well is involved on it, the stroke and heart disease prevention presentation. Members of the committee, we have two fairly brief presentations, and encourage you to stay around for them. I think they're worth hearing. With that, welcome to the committee. Ms. Callahan, are you going to join them? Or okay. Go ahead in whatever order you wish, and please introduce yourselves to the committee as you start.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you, and good afternoon. My name is Craig Akam. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Minnesota Department of Health. And it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Stan Shandling, who is the director of our Stroke and Heart Disease Prevention Unit at the Minnesota Department of Health, to give you an update on our efforts in regards to that program.
Thank you, Chairman Marty and committee members. Once again, my name is Dr. Stan Shandling. I head the Heart Disease and Stroke Prevention Unit at the Department of Health. I've been asked to come before you today to give you a snapshot of where we sit in the state of Minnesota as it relates to heart disease and stroke for the citizens of our state. I'm sure Dr. Magnin, and by the way, I applaud your confirmation of Dr. Magnin. She's a wonderful colleague. I'm sure she would agree that where we are headed is typically in the right direction, but we still have some major areas that we need to address. In your hands, I provided for you not only a mid-course review, which is this document here, but also some highlights of my testimony, which I'm about to give you. First and foremost, I think what I'd like to do is give you an idea of the urgency of what we're dealing with as it relates to heart disease and stroke. If I were to ask any one of us, whether you're sitting around the table here or in the audience here, I would almost venture to say that all of us have been touched somehow or other by heart disease and stroke, whether it be a loved one or a significant other or a friend. And certainly the statistics in the state of Minnesota are starting to bear that out. If we take heart disease and stroke and combine it together under the aegis of cardiovascular health, we are basically seeing that this is the number one cause of death in the state of Minnesota. It accounts for approximately 28% of all the deaths, and that accounts specifically for 10,300 people annually. Now, if we also add another factor as it relates to heart disease and stroke, we see annually approximately 63,000 hospitalizations related to this. And what does that translate to into cost? It's about $2.1 billion annually in this state alone. Now, fortunately, we are seeing some gains. In 2004, an illustrious group of heart disease and stroke prevention professionals, including cardiologists and neurologists, et cetera, put together our state strategic plan, and this was through 2010. In your hand is a mid-course review. In other words, where are we? Halfway or a little bit more than halfway as it relates to the issues related to heart disease and stroke. There are some encouraging signs and some things that are, frankly, troubling. For instance, on the handout that I gave you, those things that are marked in bold, you'll note that things such as high blood pressure, high blood cholesterol, diabetes, being obese, and or overweight are basically trending in the wrong direction. Commissioner Magnin noted that we are now number two in state rankings across the United States. We used to be, quite honestly, number one for many, many years, but now we're number two. And why is that? Because since 1992, the incidence of obesity in this state has increased 142%. 142%. So what does that mean? That means that even though we are dealing with our people medically, we have basically a time bomb that's starting to tick, and we're going to have a lot of people presenting themselves into the healthcare arena that are either diabetic, obese, or what we're starting to see is the incidence of people that are presenting themselves with heart failure at younger ages. The other thing that I've noted of late, and actually we had some discussions early about this at the health department at a meeting I was at this morning, is how we identify each and every one of us as it relates to disease. And after being in this field for over 30 years now, I've come to realize a couple of things, and that's this. You either are not sick. And what we do for you from a public health perspective is we want to prevent you from getting it, whatever it may be. And by the way, it could be beyond heart disease and stroke. It could be many of the chronic diseases. Or you are sick. You have had an event. For instance, if you've had a heart attack or you've had or suffered a stroke, and if you were fortunate enough to have lived through that particular episode, what is it that we do for you? Not only from a medical perspective, but also from a public health perspective, in order to prevent another occurrence. For those of you who have had, or those of you who know of people who have had a heart attack or stroke, for all intent and purposes, those people are dubbed patients for the rest of their lives. And what does that mean? That means that for those people, we deal with things from a prevention standpoint a little bit differently. We deal with things such as medication management for these people. We deal with things such as physical activity, but at different levels than perhaps the normal population would be. Also, we look at things such as cardiac rehabilitation, which could be an ongoing thing for the rest of these people's lives. And the thing is that the more sophisticated we become with our medical intervention, the more people we will be seeing in that population group. From a public policy perspective, I'll leave it to you to read pages 33 and 34 of this document, which gives some recommendations that have been put forth by the Heart Disease and Stroke Statewide Steering Committee. But I will highlight for you a couple of barriers that we are running into that we really need to start addressing. And those things include things such as better education for all of us on the signs and symptoms of heart disease and stroke. By the way, this is not just a state interest, but also a national interest through the Centers for Disease Control. A commitment of various population groups to address heart disease and stroke is a major public health and medical issue. One of the things that we also are seeing in this state is that there are certain population groups that are at higher risk for heart disease and stroke, namely Afro-American population, American Indian population, and Hispanics. We are also seeing geographic disparities. And for those of you who are from different parts of the state, we do have information as part of our burden report that can give you indications of what is happening in your particular area of the state specifically as it relates to heart disease and stroke. We also have challenges of elevating the stature of health risks in the public eye. Namely, if indeed I suffer or I have a heart attack, the perception in the public's eye now unfortunately, is not to worry. Medical intervention will take care of you. And frankly, they're right. They will, but the problem is that we're paying for that in many, many different ways. We need better coordination across and between programs. And to that, I have to compliment many, many of our partners around the state of Minnesota, the Heart Association, the Stroke Association, many of the different health plans. As you can imagine, all the different clinics and hospital systems, these are all partners. And truly, these are the ones that are really in the trenches that are really trying to hopefully prevent, but at the same time treat these people. And then finally, one of the things I want to note for you all before I open it up for any questions is the concept of access to care. When we look at disparities, it's very easy to look at it from a population basis, but there's also geographic disparities. For instance, I'll just pick one. Polk County, for instance, and I don't know if any of you are from there or close to there, but Polk County has a very high incidence of stroke. And you might ask why. Well, one of the reasons is the access to care. When you are suffering from a stroke, you have typically a three-hour window to get care, especially if you're suffering from what's called an ischemic stroke, which is a constriction. If you are not able to get to a hospital within that period of time, you have a higher probability of suffering the consequences from that stroke. And so how is it? How is it that we can address these issues as from a statewide basis in order to affect the public's health? Finally, I'll note, and then I'll open it up, is on pages 11 and 12 are particular action plans that are specifics as it relates to the strategic plan on what the steering committee believes are things that we really should be focused on first. As you can imagine, there are many, many things, but how is it that we prioritize these things? And you can read those on your own. With that, I will close, and if there are any questions, I'd be happy to entertain them.
Thank you. Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Dr. Shandling. I just wanted to comment on page 16, where we're being updated on the key modifiable risk factors. And of everything in this report, I think that's perhaps what's most disheartening. It's always good that we make our decisions based on facts. And the facts are that there are clearly some things, arguably within control, that are trending in the wrong direction, continue to trend in the wrong direction in the state of Minnesota. And I think that it would be important for this committee to understand that. Well, we have a series of reports. This one today happens to be heart and stroke. I don't believe that the issue at hand is that we haven't recognized the problem or that, frankly, we don't know what needs to be done. But having said all of those wonderful, fine things, we are not trending in the right direction. And the other thing that I wanted to just point out was on page 36. In the conclusion. And it says in part that the continual commitment of all entities appears to be the key. It's not that we don't know what needs to be done or how to do it, but we need a true commitment. So I just point that out since we are the policy committee. I'm hopeful that we will see some policy discussions coming forward that address some of those key modifiable risk factors. And to the department and to Dr. Shandling, I hope, and perhaps you'd like to comment on how this particular report or this particular work might fit more broadly in the umbrella of the overall prevention and the seemingly strong commitment that is being brought forward with regard to public health. And can you give us some assurance that heart and stroke is not operating out here in its silo, while we seemingly have a very large public health commitment that is at least seeking to get off the ground.
Senator Torres-Rae and Senator Lynch, thank you.
I
certainly appreciate your comments, and I know you've been a strong advocate for this arena. Specifically, I think what's important from a policy perspective is this, that many of the risk factors that are being addressed in the present state plan through SHIP, the State Health Improvement Program, are very complementary in the area of heart disease and stroke. I go on record as saying that. If you're dealing with obesity, obviously, based on what we're seeing here, and things are trending in the wrong direction, we're addressing those. If we're dealing with tobacco, even though, according to this report, tobacco is getting a little bit better, that doesn't mean we should rest on our laurels. So I would say that the SHIP bill is very complementary, and it certainly is a start. Is it all-inclusive? No. Is it a way, like I've always said, in order to get these things moving, you got to get the train rolling. You really do have to get the train rolling, and I believe and I support that effort. Are there more things that we can do that are, shall we say, more directly focused on heart disease and stroke specifically? Yes, I could argue that. But I would say, at this point, let's get the train rolling.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Shanley, thank you very much. I wanted to kind of piggyback off what Senator Lynch has started in this direction, and I'm troubled that I look at the trends that are good, you know, and that it seems though personal behaviors, we're eating better, we're getting more activity, physical activity, we're smoking less, and yet our diabetes rates and high blood pressure and cholesterol are going up. I mean, can you kind of pinpoint or start, give me an idea why that might be if we're starting to do the right things and yet these other factors are still trending upward?
Yeah,
the key
to that, Senator, though, is basically that we're seeing the incidence of obesity more and more at younger ages. And unfortunately, you know, with a lot of technology that we have right now, we're seeing, even though we're seeing some things creep in the right direction as far as physical activity, in other words, we're getting a little bit better. The question is, are we getting better enough to catch up with the incidence of obesity that we have? And the answer to that is no. And unless we really start really focusing very, very carefully on that, then obesity and the complications from it will overtake it, and then we'll have to be treating it for things such as diabetes, heart disease, and stroke.
Madam Chair, thank you. And Dr. Shanley, then that leads me to my next question or what I'd like you to touch on is that I see here it's better early detection screening methods and willingness to accept these new methods. I'm assuming that, you know, you're talking about in childhood now that there, at some point the lifestyle choices that we're making that lead to a more susceptibility or prevalence of heart disease and stroke must occur at a certain stage in life. I don't know if that's all of it's in early, you know, in the childhood years or it's teens or young adulthood, or later adulthood. Where along that continuum are we to need to focus our attentions to get that information to help people adjust their lifestyles? Maybe they were doing well before and they started to change over the years and now they're doing things that they shouldn't be, or is it that they're just starting off in the wrong foot and we need to focus all our attentions there? Can you address that?
Yeah. Senator Torres, Senator Dole, you can thank a lot of this to mom and dad. Okay, so in other words, there's a lot of things that are genetically that you have, and we just have to deal with that. So that's part of that answer, okay? I happen to be one of those, okay? Thanks to mom and dad, I'm on particular types of medication, okay? However, at what age do we really start pushing this type of information? And this might be really kind of a cop-out, but the sooner the better. But that's a hard one to take, and I'll tell you why. I teach at the University of Minnesota, and I have young students. And when I start telling them these types of things, they look at me, quite frankly, like I have beans in my head. You know, why should I worry about this? Because those people have the illusion of immortality. Okay, they haven't seen it. They aren't touched by it. But until people are touched by it, they aren't affected. The problem is we will see people being touched by it at younger ages now. And so that illusion of immortality that many younger people have is going to go away. And what that means is that, unfortunately, it then becomes a great opportunity for education. Okay. It's unfortunate.
Thank you.
Senator Worgen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Shanling, thank you for recognizing genetics as part of the equation. I can testify that that has a lot to do with it.
Absolutely.
I'm kind of on that same vein of putting things in context that Senator Dahl was on. I too saw the what I saw almost as an anomaly, that the lifestyles are getting a little bit better, and yet we still have some of the problems getting worse. But along with that, can you tell me over the course of, I don't know, I guess I don't really know how many years, but let's say 10 years, is the average life expectancy in Minnesota getting shorter or longer?
Senator Torres-Ray and Senator Worgland, the life expectancy, here's the other thing, that we're all going to die eventually from something, okay, all of us, all right? And the life expectancy in the state of Minnesota is actually trending a little bit higher than the national average, and it's coming in at around 80 years, okay? Now, the key, what we're dealing with here, is it's not only longevity of life, because all of us want to live a little longer or have our loved ones live a little longer, but it's the quality of the life along the way. And we all value that in a different way. But I will tell you this, that if our younger people are going to start being affected by it, I would venture to say that most of our values are in line, all of us are in line with something's out of sync if it's starting to hit a younger population.
Senator Worgen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's kind of where my second question was coming from. When you talk about heart disease and stroke, can you tell me how that's trending? Is the age trending upward or downward? Can you tell me, since 2000 is the average age of someone experiencing beginning heart disease or a stroke, getting younger?
Senator Marty and Senator Worgen, in the state of Minnesota, well, let me start. Nationally, we're getting worse. We're getting worse as far as heart disease and stroke. In the state of Minnesota, we're getting slightly better, only in the sense of the fact that this state has been ranked as number one as far as medical intervention is concerned. So what does that mean? It gets back to what I originally said in my testimony, that people are walking around with heart disease or from the stroke, but they've been effectively treated. And then they become part of that population base that I've dubbed being a patient for the rest of your life.
Madam Chair.
Senator Worgen.
But I understand that, but I'm actually asking the question, are they younger when they're having that stroke or the beginning of heart disease, or are they not?
Senator Marty, and say, yes, younger.
Thank you.
Any other questions, members? Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Shandling. Would you like to testify? Are you enlisted
no,
to testify?
No,
okay. Thank you. Thank you, and welcome to the committee.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Rachel Callanan. I'm Senior Advocacy Director with the American Heart Association, and I just wanted to add a few comments to Dr. Shandling's testimony today. First, I just want to thank the committee for taking the time to hear about these important issues. I know it is a very busy time for you, but I think in terms of the healthcare reform discussions that are currently happening at the Capitol, this information is particularly important for you to help you make your decisions about some of those policies moving forward. I just wanted to mention, too, that Senator Lynch does have a bill that would provide new funding for the Heart Disease and Stroke Prevention Unit. And last year, that bill was partially funded by the Senate, and it, unfortunately, the money did not survive all the way through the process. But I wanted to commend you for your leadership on that front. I would like to provide you with four reasons why I believe, and the Heart Association believes, that Minnesota should invest money in the Heart Disease and Stroke Prevention Unit. And I know this is not the Finance Committee, but I wanted to take this opportunity to just highlight how a very small investment could really have long-lasting, very much ripple effects through the healthcare systems. So first of all, the first reason I want to provide you, as Dr. Shandling mentioned, cardiovascular diseases are the number one cause of death in Minnesota, causing about 28% of deaths in Minnesota. Number two reason, the cost of failing to prevent and address heart disease and stroke and the risk factors are unsustainable, and this has been a very key part of the healthcare reform discussions. I just wanted to mention a report recently released by Blue Cross Blue Shield and the Minnesota Department of Health, a joint report that they just issued. They found that by 2010, two-thirds of Minnesotans will be overweight or obese, with 27% being obese. The numbers are worse by 2020, with just 23% of Minnesotans at a healthy weight, and this is if current trends continue. Not only are these projections costly in terms of lives, they are financially costly to our state. It's predicted that if these trends go unchecked, the obesity trends go unchecked, the increase in health care costs will be $1 billion by 2010 and $3.7 billion by 2020. And that seems like a long way off, but it's, you know, just around the corner that some of these financial impacts will be experienced. A third reason that we should consider funding the Heart Disease and Stroke Prevention Unit: the healthcare reform discussions underway really focus on that prevention and improving treatment of chronic diseases. And I know a number of you have been sitting around those tables and discussions. And a very important part of the proposal is this statewide health improvement program that Dr. Shandling already discussed. Those kinds of programs would definitely make a huge impact on reducing the costs. Finally, the state investment in this program would allow Minnesota to be competitive for funding from the CDC. Currently, the Heart Disease and Stroke Prevention Unit gets funding only from the CDC for planning around heart disease and stroke prevention. We have not been able to tap into the competitive funds for what they call basic implementation. And so we would like the state to invest some money towards this planning and implementation so that we are better positioned in that competitive process to get that funding. That's all I really have to add today. I'd be happy to stand for questions. I really appreciate your willingness to take the time to discuss this issue today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee. Senator Higgins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Callanan, the report that we heard today reminds us that there's a huge disparity in health, healthiness in our communities of color. And could you talk a bit about what the American Heart Association is doing in the communities of color?
Yeah, the American Heart Association actually has made health disparities one of our priorities, and some of our specific programs that we are pursuing to address some of those concerns have to do with messaging and information in those minority communities. So we have specific programs targeted, and a lot of them are faith-based, actually, going into churches and places of worship to promote understanding the signs of stroke, that sort of thing, so that people are better better equipped to know that they may have these health risks and to address them. We also, at the state level, we are supporting health care reform, and as a subcomponent of that, absolutely looking at the health disparities in health care coverage.
Further questions? Senator Dell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Callanan, on this map that you showed us, I don't know if you can answer this question or not, but I'm looking at it. I'm noticing that at least in the metropolitan area, it seems as though there's an island where, you know, it's under 30%, and you've got places outstate where they're 38, 36, 41, 50% of all the deaths are related to heart disease or stroke. Can you address that at all? Is it just that they're getting better care in the Twin Cities, or what might be the cause for that?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Senator Dahl, I think Dr. Shandling addressed one contributing factor is access to care and access to really quick treatment. That is definitely an issue, and I think is demonstrated in the map.
Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Callanan, thank you. Ms. Callanan, thank you for reminding us that what you bring to us today is the number one cause of death in Minnesota. And I wanted to comment, remind members a little bit. Ms. Callanan said that the bill that was introduced last session didn't survive through the process, was largely supported by this body. And members, what that didn't survive through the process really means is that this very provision fell victim to a line item veto.
Thank you for pointing that out. Ms. Callanan, if you could wave a magic wand and get the funding you think is needed for the heart disease and stroke prevention unit and carry out not just a plan, but to carry out the plan, how much would that be in a year?
Mr. Chair, we believe that $400,000 per year to fund the work of the heart disease and stroke prevention unit would be sufficient to continue out the implementation of the plan. To absolutely fulfill all parts of the plan will take the partnership of, you know, a lot of the partners that Dr. Shandling mentioned, state, local, public health, health plans, hospitals. So, you know, the state does not need to completely be responsible for all those costs, but certainly needs to play a role, we believe, in promoting this plan.
Any clue how much all partners together would have to pay to make the prevention plan a reality statewide, a full level of it? I mean, not that this is going to happen, but just your estimate of how much everyone would be putting into prevention on related to heart and stroke?
Mr. Chair, I don't think I can answer that today for a number of reasons. I think a lot of the components of the plan are about systems change, and I think it would be tough to put a dollar figure to some of the changes that would be happening in the local community.
Thank you very much. If there are no further questions, Senator Higgins, one last question.
One more thing that just occurs to me, and maybe somebody who's on the K-12 committee can remind me if I'm correct or not, but it seems to me that Minnesota no longer has mandatory, I see some nodding, physical education in schools. And that would seem to me to be the most logical place to start, you know, getting kids used to exercise, you know, running off some of the craziness that you know, they can have during a school day, but also getting them to just incorporate that into you know, part of their daily lives. And I'm thinking we're a little short-sighted on that, Mr. Chair.
Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Higgins, thank you very much for bringing that up. I believe last session we did have a bill that would have moved PE back into a curriculum.
Every year.
But it dovetails to one of the questions I was thinking about earlier about either asking Dr. Shandling or you, Ms. Callanan. The fact is that as we're going to deal with some of these things, we cross over many departments. This is not just a health, I mean, we're the healthcare policy committee, but it has to do with the education department, it has to do with business and industry because we're talking about the health of the workforce. There's business policy we're talking about, school education policy, health insurance company policy, which Senator, oh no, that's Senator Scheid's committee. Perhaps who's that yours, Senator? Okay. But there's lots of different departments that these policies affect. And until we get away from dealing with healthcare and education and education, and start connecting the systems in a different way, it's going to be very difficult for us to deal with anything, because otherwise all we're doing is cost shifting to another department. It may look like a solution to us, but we've just shifted it onto the private sector. Or as you're suggesting, Senator Higgins said, it's great, and I support that idea, but it's really hard to pick up in education because of all the financial implications for new teachers and new instruction and how it breaks out as far as a financial impact to the school district. So we're always struggling with how do we do that. So we need to look at our whole way of doing business at the Capitol and maybe acknowledge that school districts are picking up healthcare costs and maybe they need to be funded differently than just simply out of the education funding stream.
Ms. Kellen.
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, and Senator Erickson-Robes, I just wanted to highlight that the Healthcare Access Commission actually made a lot of progress, I think, on that front through the Public Health Working Group that Senator Torres Ray chaired. And out of that Public Health Working Group came proposals to address physical education in schools and to be focused on this community-based approach that really pulled in partnerships with local public health schools, and that is the statewide health improvement plan. And so I think those are very good examples of policy that really, that you know, the state could control to move this issue forward. And I did want to mention that our physical education standards bill is moving forward. It's Senator Tomasoni's bill. It has been included in the omnibus policy education bill in Senator Wieger's bill currently, and what it would entail is to create statewide academic standard for physical education and require a half of a credit to graduate from high school.
Half a credit.
Thank you. Further discussion? If not, thank you, and thanks to the department for the presentation. It was very helpful. We also have one more presentation on the healthcare workforce shortage and an interesting program in Hennepin County, Hennepin and Carver County, I guess, to address this. And welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Joe Samarja. I'm the lobbyist for the Hennepin Carver Workforce Board, and we've had this bill. Senator Higgins has been our author for the last couple of years, and we've been kind of frustrated because we've been in the Jobs Committee, and we think it's very important. That's why I came to the Mr. Chairman to see if we could do a presentation on the issues that we see that are coming up. Last year, we had some funding. It was line item vetoed. This year, the Jobs Committee has less money than ever. So I have John McLaughlin and Director of Hennepin County, and Dr. Bruce Knoth, who is the senior analyst for Hennepin County, to make a presentation.
And I'm glad you did ask us, because I think while this is the jurisdiction of the Jobs Committee, I think there are a lot of people here because, I mean, the whole talk about healthcare reform, one of the biggest concerns is lack of providers and workers who have the skills they need. And so making this committee aware of it may help. Let's hope it helps in terms of pushing it through in the other committee. So Please identify yourselves again, Mr. Noth, if you're going to be the one beginning. Or?
First of all, Mr. Chairman, my name is John McLaughlin. I'm the director of Hennepin Carver, suburban Hennepin County, and Carver County Workforce Development. And this program was started under a federal grant in 2003 and was refinished in 2006. And I just wanted to point out that it has a lot of elected official support. I was going to point out Senator Berglund, but she had something else to do, so she's moved along. But in fact, Senator Berglund and Representative Ramstad are both in the final report, and Dr. Noth will speak to you about the looming shortage in workers in the healthcare industry, which will sort of make most of what you've talked about today kind of moot.
Go ahead. Mr. Chairman, my name is Dr. Noth, Bruce Noth, and thank you for the opportunity to be here, and thank you, members of the committee. I want to thank you also for the work that you did on the as a large body on the transportation bill to address the infrastructure of our buildings and whatnot. And it reminds me that the tragic collapse of the 35W bridge might not have happened if that work had been done sooner. And it further reminds me that the tragedy of the 35W bridge will pale in comparison to the tragedy that will happen if we don't address the needed infrastructure in healthcare, and particularly the need for public health workers at all levels, doctors, nurses, epidemiologists, et cetera. We won't be losing 10, 15 people. It'll be tens of thousands of people. As the good doctor that was here before mentioned, Dr. Shanley, with just the issue of heart disease and stroke, we're looking at 63,000 people. 63,000. That's one disease, one group of people, and it's in 1 year. As we look down the road to the looming demographic changes with increasing baby boomers and the age and the retirement, et cetera, and the needed health care that they will need, what we're looking at is something that's very, very dramatically needed, and that's just to increase, and I'm not telling you anything new. You've heard it 1,000 times from 1,000 different quarters. Again, it's just a tremendous issue if we don't take care of it. I'm just going to run through things here kind of quickly. Again, the workforce is aging in Minnesota. It definitely is aging. We have fewer people entering our labor force. This is some of the data on it. 90% fewer workers in 2010 than in 1970. 1970 is when a lot of the baby boomers entered the workforce. 80% of the workforce of 2005 is now working. 80%. We've tapped out our workforce and our labor force in Minnesota particularly. We are number one in labor force participation in the number of women working. We're ninth in terms of workers who have more than one job, and we're second in the average age of workers. Again, in Minnesota, we're going to see a decrease in the working age available to us. We're going to see it drop off dramatically in the next 10 years to 15 years. Combined with that, we have advances in medical technology, all sorts of advances. It's likely we're going to continue to see those.
Can I interrupt for a second about the question about the last slide?
Yes, sir.
The decrease in Minnesota's workforce population's percentage, in other words, that's the percentage of which new people are coming in, or the what's that percentage of the
people ages 15 to 64 in the workforce? And when
it's decreasing by, I'm not really, more than 7% of people age 15 to 64 are in the workplace. I'm trying to figure out what the percentage is.
The decrease in the percentage of, there's a negative coming into the workforce.
OK. Okay, so it had been growing, not as fast as the population, but now it's going to actually be falling.
Correct.
Okay.
We talked a little bit earlier about the baby boomers, and there are approximately 70 million that we know about in this country. And if I can give you an image, they're on a train, and that train has left the depot. 70 million baby boomers and another 20 to 40 million uninsured individuals have left the depot. They're on a fast-moving and highly powerful train. There's a lot of inertia to this. As people age, they have more hospital visits, more incidents, more difficulties. The number that Dr. Shanley gave, 63,000 incidents of heart attack among our individuals in Minnesota, is frightening. I think it's going to continue, and as we saw with the obesity and the blood pressure issues. At the same time, we have less of a supply of healthcare workers. This particular chart is involved nurses, but it also applies to the other allied healthcare professions. At the same time we have increasing need, we have a decreasing supply of workers. Who is going to be there to help us? When we're in that gurney and we're being rushed to the emergency room, who will be there? Who will be there besides us in the gurney? I want to suggest to you that this train is on the track and there's a canyon that we're going to have to cross. And it's coming in the next 10 to 20 years. And the bridge is out. Again, if the 35W bridge was a tragedy, wait, because this will be a huge, huge tragedy affecting tens of thousands. When the federal government gave us this money, they wanted to see three things. They wanted to see if we could work together systemically, if we could get wages and increases for individuals, and if we could increase their educational and occupational outcomes. And they wanted to see if three systems could work together: higher ed, workforce agencies, and healthcare employers.
And Dr. North, this $3 million Department of Labor grant that it talks about here, what year was that made?
Mr. Chairman, that was 2003 we were granted the funds.
For what year period was
3-year period.
3-year period, okay.
We worked together with higher education, with healthcare employers, private employers, and the six counties in the local area, seven county local metro area. And we also worked with Twin Cities Teamsters Service Bureau. Together with these six counties and an independent nonprofit, we worked together with most of the major healthcare providers in the metro area: Alina, Hennepin County Medical Center — obviously we're from Hennepin County — Fairview, Healtheast, Health Partners, Park Nicollet, North Memorial, Fremont Clinics, were just a couple of the ones that we worked with. Together with education, we had to tap out every single educational institution in Minnesota to get our folks the training that they needed. We worked with about 30-some institutions, not only in Minnesota. We had to go outside of Minnesota, and we had to go online in order to get the training to help people move through and get their certifications. We had 527 people in this program. Of that, 462 completed successfully. 427 got a license and or certification. The majority of the folks were RNs, and they either received an additional certification, an upgrade, or became MSNs. A number of folks moved from nursing assistant to LPNs and RNs. But we did also deal with we had 20 different occupations that actually participated. The majority, 423, got a wage increase. We have to report the wages to Department of Labor, and they track them. We were also interested to see how many would get a job promotion out of this, an actual promotion from what they were doing, and 336 got those.
Dr. Noah, a question on that, too. You have almost 80% got a license and or certification. That would mean an LPN getting an RN certification, and the fact that a lesser amount obtained job promotion. Would that mean some of them stayed as like an LPN?
Correct.
Because they couldn't get a, they didn't get a promotion yet, though, presumably.
Within the one, Mr. Chairman, sir, within the 1 year time frame that we were looking at them, they did not, yes.
But presumably, if 80% got another degree or license or certification, presumably that same 80% is going to be promoted within a year or so.
Correct. Again, the outcomes that we experienced were far greater than we expected. We thought we'd only be able to enroll 300. We were able to enroll 527. The biggest reason for that is the profound financial assistance that we also got directly from employers. Employers gave a cash match, 50 cents on the dollar. So they contributed $1.5 million in cash assistance for their particular employees. This was...
Can I interrupt again? I'm sorry.
Yes,
this
sir.
Is helpful, but in effect, if an LPN is working at Hennepin County Medical Center and they're studying to become an RN, Hennepin County Medical Center would have put in that 50 cents on the dollar with the commitment that that person is going to stay employed at Hennepin County?
Correct. Correct. And or the others. Now, there's...
Right.
There's nobody that can lock them into that, but that was kind of the idea. Again, we served significantly more people than we thought we were going to be able to serve. We saw their educational attainment. We were shooting in the 80%. We saw 88 get increased educational attainment. And, again, we saw 80% getting a wage increase. And some of those wage increases were significant. People moving from nursing assistant to RN, people moving from LPN into RN, et cetera. They made some significant jumps. We originally planned to only serve 7 occupations. We ended up serving 20 different occupations. And again, a key to the success of this program, without it, we couldn't have done it, was the employers. We saw significant jumps within different categories. For wages at placement as they got their degrees and as they moved on. One of the things that we found from the project was that coordination between and among agencies is difficult, but it is possible. We were dealing with organized labor here. We were dealing with county governments. We were dealing with individual employers. We were dealing with individuals, and then we were dealing with workforce agencies. And those are a lot of systems to get your hands around, but it is possible. The biggest single problem we found was the lack of access to educational and training. As I'm sure you know, we have waiting lists in some cases for certain occupations in healthcare in our public systems, and this was a real problem for us. This is where the bottleneck is. It's education, access, and capacity. The other thing with that is, in order to do something like this, you have to really focus your resources. If you don't, you won't get it done. And there's both public and private resources have to be targeted and focused in order to attain these kinds of outcomes. Again, most of our labor force agencies have access to people. Most of our employers have access to people and are willing to submit cash. Where we really have the trouble is with educational access, capacity, educational capacity. Regardless of whether this program gets funded or continues, the lessons learned from it are extremely important, and that's it's a continuum. It's a three-legged stool between labor force and workforce agencies, between education, and between employers. If one of those doesn't work, the thing doesn't work. It breaks down. We have a failure in the workforce paradigm. We don't have a successful outcome if one of those legs is short or doesn't work. In our case, the biggest problem we had was we had nowhere to send people for training. We had money. We had people. We had employers who had money. We had the people, the money, and the wherewithal, but we had nowhere to send them. We started scrambling to get them in wherever we could. We did online, which 3-4 years ago was still a new thing. And we did, we accessed private, almost every private institution in Minnesota. I think we had 18 different MNSCU institutions participating. University of Minnesota is fairly small because of the particular occupations that they focus on. But that was the biggest lesson learned. And from this, we need more, and I know you know this, and I'm sure you hear it all the time, more funding for education. But having worked at MNSCU for 10 years, I would encourage the realignment of certain programs, public resources, for some of our most profound needs. If we're facing this kind of a crisis in 10, 15 years, why are we funding 600 different programs? I'm not saying that any one of those programs is bad. I don't want to focus on that. But there is a question here, and I think it is an important policy question. We found that most of the people, if they were given a chance to advance and if they were given a chance to go back to school, even while working, they did it. It took a tremendous effort on the parts of individuals to do this. It took a tremendous effort on the part of the employers and the workforce agencies to coordinate all of this. It really entails a great deal of partnership and relationship among those three separate systems. And we're thankful, and we would like to continue this in some fashion if possible. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. North. You turned out a lot of new RNs and a lot of new advanced practice nurses and a lot of new LPNs, 80% of your people. Question then, though, what you were saying about higher education. In effect, the problem was not getting healthcare workers inspired to say, I'm going to go to school to move up the career ladder. The problem wasn't getting them trained or getting their employers happy to even help pay for some of it. The biggest problem you had was lack of positions at MNSCU and so on to take them. So in other words, if refunding or providing more funding for programs like this, or I don't know if Rochester has things like this, but one of the biggest, we can't just do this unless we're going to also beef up MNSCU's capacity to train. Questions from committee. Sir Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it Mr. McLaughlin?
That's me, ma'am.
Okay, I'm sorry. I think I
that's Dr. Knoth over there.
Dr. Knoth, thank you for the presentation. It seems to me that you're outlining an exactly perfect illustration of what we just talked about with physical education and the education system having a health care cost. And until we at the Capitol get to a place where we reconceptualize how we do business legislatively, we're going to be faced with the same kind of capacity issues broken down into all the different little silos that we have before us. Because what turns out on the street levels being a huge health care cost could be resolved if we put more money into workforce development, or as you're suggesting, more money into higher ed. But these are not recognized as health care costs. They're recognized as higher educational costs or workforce development costs, and nobody's connecting the dots. And I think that's what your report does, as well as the presentation we had earlier. So, you know, I would just suggest some of the findings you're having here is, you know, primarily a lack of capacity with educational institutions and funding for workforce. Another primary problem is the fact that we have I don't know how I'm going to say this, a lack of capacity in revisualizing legislative implementation of these things you're bringing to us, because we are set up in little silos right now, and we don't necessarily talk to each other, and we need to form bridges and partnerships between the divisions at the Capitol in order to deal with these things. Otherwise, there's going to be a huge healthcare outcome out there in the state that we might be able to address preventatively with funding through the three different stools, or legs of the stool that you're talking about. So I just want to say very clearly, I think one of the big problems, not only in healthcare, but whether we're dealing with our transportation issues or our environmental issues or educational, we have to have different departments talking to each other.
Senator Brittner Solon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it was 3 and 4 years ago I was vice chair of both health budget and higher ed budget. And in my capacity, I sponsored some legislation for capacity building at the Minsky colleges, as well as we furthered our career ladder program. And there was some funding for scholarships for those that went into educating RNs and healthcare providers. And I'm wondering if that has had an impact yet. If that capacity building has occurred and whether we are having more people preparing to get out there to be educating our future healthcare professionals.
Senator, let me try to answer that. what you will find across our system, the workforce development system, are a lot of people who want to serve the healthcare industry. There's very little, as you suggested, cross-pollination between those. The very same thing has happened with the state systems. We have not seen a great deal, although we've been looking for it, of additional capacity to train people. I know that North Hennepin Community College, for instance, is looking to build a building in the potato field that they bought across the street, but they can't get any bonding money or anything to build the building. That building might be used to help train healthcare workers. I just talked to Joe Opatz down at Normandale Community College. Same problem there. They have no room to train more people. And so that's an issue that perhaps needs to be taken care of, and I don't know where.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I know some of it's going on because I know that there's an expansion at Lake Superior College, and I also know that there was some money that had gone up to the Hibbing area for capacity building also. But I don't, and I also thought there were some in the metro area. I realize that it may be a small amount compared to our need, but it may be something we need to expand on.
Senator Erickson-Robes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to respond to Senator Prettner-Solon. I think that's a fabulous idea, and I don't know if some of the expansion that's gone on in southeastern Minnesota is related to your bill, but if it is, thank you very much. Southeastern Technical just did an expansion of their programs, but I do know the need is tremendous out there. At Winona State University, we have 200 students that are qualified and ready to get into the nurses program, the RN program at Winona State, that are turned away every year because they don't have the room. That's 200 students that have the desire and the grades and the ambition to become nurses. And there's just not enough room in the higher ed system. They don't have enough training sites for clinical, and they don't have enough clinical instructors. That's another huge problem. So we have this tremendous bottleneck. We have people that are interested, and that's again where I would just say, you know, I think we're causing part of the problem at the legislature because we have this system. It's a systems function that's dysfunctional here.
Dr. Knott.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Solon, a couple of years ago, there was a $6 million appropriation to Minsky to do what you described, and some of that work has begun, particularly one of the other issues, one of the capacity issues, is the lack of qualified instructors. Business or, you know, private sector hospitals, et cetera, really want those people as well. And so there's high competition for them, and that's a tremendous additional need within the problem. It's a problem within the problem. But the legislature, and thanks to the work of this group and others, did provide that. But it is that drop in the desert, so to speak. when we look at the scope of this problem, it's huge. I mean, 63,000 just in heart issues alone. We expand that and we consider that 70 million baby boomers are entering retirement age within a year. 2010, the clock starts to tick for them. We've got a huge, huge gap. And 6 million here and 6 million there. The feds gave us 3 million here. They gave us, they gave another agency 3 million down in southwest Minnesota to do health academies. There's additional monies here and there, but it's drips and drops and dribbles, and we'll take everything we can get. But it is a huge problem.
Given the depth of the demand, I mean, not just at Hennepin County, but all the big systems, Mayo Clinic, up in Duluth, everywhere, their demand for healthcare workers, somehow we hear that softly around here. It seems to me they would be wise to work with you in terms of coming here and raising the level of awareness of the issue and the urgency of it. So I appreciate your taking the time to come here and present to us, and I hope our committee can help you with the economic development folks in getting funding to help push this, and again, higher education folks in getting funding for higher education institutions. Any further discussion from the committee? If not, I appreciate you all hanging around for these presentations and appreciate your making them.
Thank you.
With that, this committee is adjourned.